Hello, I'm Harry Glorikian, and this is Moneyball Medicine, the show where we meet executives, entrepreneurs, physicians, and scientists using the power of data to reinvent healthcare. From machine learning to genomics to personalized medicine, we look at the biggest trends in patient care and healthcare management. And we talk to people behind the trends to find out where data is making the biggest difference. My next guest, Dr. Alan Copperman, is director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, as well as the vice chairman of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Science at Mount Sinai Medical Center. Dr. Copperman is a clinical professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and also serves as the medical director of Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. He is also the chief medical officer of Semaphore Genomics, a patient-centered health intelligence company, and the medical director of Progyny, which operates as a fertility benefits management company. Dr. Copperman is frequently quoted in print and digital media, Associated Press, Wall Street Journal, U.S. News World Report, New York Times, Daily News, and more, and is featured on local and nationally televised news shows, including Fox 5, New York Live, CBS This Morning, Huffington Post, and more. Dr. Copperman has been named to New York Magazine's list of best doctors 16 years in a row, and Castle, Connolly, and SuperDocs have annually recognized Dr. Copperman as one of the top fertility doctors. Dr. Copperman, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Copperman, you know, tell us a little bit about your journey. Reproductive health, data analytics, Semaphore genomics, you know, tell us where you started and how you've gotten into this whole data gig.
Well, I was formally trained as an OBGYN, and then I did a fellowship in reproductive endocrinology, and I thought that treating infertility was going to be being a reproductive surgeon. So I started off doing a lot of laparoscopies and taking out fibroids and hysteroscopy using fiber optic scopes to take out polyps and fibroids. And then over time, I realized that much of taking care of the infertile patient or infertile couple was going to be done in a dish with and operating was going to be done on eggs and sperm and embryos. And so I transitioned from more of a surgeon to helping to build RMA of New York, which is a pretty large IVF center now that's taking care of thousands of patients a year. And with this transition came the need to collect data and learn about what the best way is to take care of patients to optimize their success rates. So I fell back on the term that you use, Moneyball Medicine, because we want to have the best embryologists, the best egg retrieving doctors, the best embryo transferring doctors. We want to put a team on the field that optimizes the success rates for every patient and every couple who walks into our doors. So I started to work with our data analysts and our computer programmers to build systems that track everything that we do and help us develop networks of information so that we can optimize pathways to improve outcomes. And I just got excited about using information to drive better decisions.
So it sounds like you're part doctor, part geneticist, part mathematics guru, some combination thereof?
Well, I like to rely on the brilliant geneticists, the brilliant mathematicians, statisticians, computer programmers to present information. So I think that my piece is translational. I can speak a little bit of each of their languages and then meet the needs of the patient by leaning on the support of people who really are the super specialists.
So when I think about this, when I put together the book Moneyball Medicine, it was all about how data was going to transform medicine. You're the in my mind, you're the poster child of starting what you know as you said in surgery and migrating to data being almost dare say central to what you do on a regular basis.
It is. I mean, we've taken from the organ system of operating on a tube and a uterus to the cellular system of operating on an egg and a sperm and taking out pieces of biopsying embryos and running next gen sequencing, so we get tens of thousands, even close to a million data points on every embryo that we sequence to figure out if they're healthy or not. So we need mathematicians to interpret the genetics code And then we have to translate it back to a human level, develop decision support tools so that the doctors can talk to patients. So it starts off with the patient and it ends in patients, but the pathway is just so completely different than it was 3 years ago, no less 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I was telling somebody, I'm like, if I stop reading for a couple of weeks, I feel like I'm woefully behind in what's going on in the space.
So, right, well, take as a perfect example, expanded carrier screening. So a couple comes in and wants to have a healthy baby, and we test mom and dad for certain recessive diseases that they may carry a mutation for. So they're healthy, but together they might be at risk of passing on a disease like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia or Tay-Sachs to the child. So 30 years ago, we just started doing some screening. 10 years ago, there were four or five diseases that ACOG, the American College of OBGYN, was recommending people be tested for. And next week, we're going from 284 diseases to 502 diseases that each patient is going to be tested for to see what they carry, what mutation in gene or what variant they carry that could cause an unhealthy child. So the mathematicians and geneticists are feeding us information that we never dreamt possible, and we're going to be able to prevent unhealthy children from being born. We're going to be able to knock genes out of families that have could potentially have caused diseases for generations. That's that perfect example of using data to drive better medical decisions.
Tell me how you and or the patients are affected by this, and tell me how this, or if it affects cost in the system.
Right. So the really important factor in any introduction of technology is the fairness of this of how it's being offered. This isn't just for rich people. This isn't just for patients that have certain commercial insurances. And is this cost effective as a system? Is this going to create cost or reduce cost? For years, in vitro fertilization was extremely expensive because patients would have twins or triplets or even higher order multiples, and there would be premature babies and millions of dollars in care, maternal fetal care that was being caused. So it wasn't a $10,000 or $15,000 IVF cycle that was driving the expenditures of the of fertility. It was really the downstream cost on mom and children and the unhealthy children that were being born from being born prematurely. These days, we use sequencing of the embryo. So spending a couple of $100 extra per embryo, we can find the healthiest embryo. We only need to put in one, so we have higher success rates and lower maternal fetal costs. So money up front spent for testing a couple for carrier screening will prevent a baby from being born with cystic fibrosis and decades of very expensive care and human suffering. And testing of an embryo will allow us to pick out one, so we have a singleton rather than a multiple, which will have a healthier baby at the end. So I think that the cost of technology is high, but the cost savings can be dramatic.
And as you were saying, this is, you know, available to everyone or a certain group. I mean, you're in New York. You're in a unique environment. How does this become something that everybody can get everywhere?
Well, fortunately, there are patient advocacy groups like Resolve that are marching on the legislature in every state to request mandates that fertility coverage be part of every plan for people that have health care, which hopefully will be all. And there are groups like Progyny that you mentioned in the introduction, which is a company that I'm fortunate to be part of, that works with employers to cover the fertility journey of their employees. So it's a great tool for a company to recruit and retain, especially female employees that are driving a lot of the fertility care. And it's also a great model because Progyny builds networks of doctors that are committed to efficient care. So we're back to using data to drive decisions. We have a report card on each doctor, so we know that how quickly they help a patient become pregnant with a healthy singleton pregnancy and have a healthy delivery, because that's actually the cost savings that employers are looking for when they're providing benefits like this. So hopefully between its legislative change, between fertility, between companies supplying benefits for their employees, I think that we're going to just keep increasing access to care to both preserve fertility for young women who are aiming to delay their childbearing until they're ready to have a family, and to cure infertility in a couple who's struggling.
Well, it's interesting because everything you just said was sort of data, right? So it's data on the analytics of the couple, but you're also, you said, a report card on the physician, which is a really interesting, aspect of seeing who's better than the others, or more efficient. I'm not sure what the report card says, but you can sort of start to pick the really good ones from the not so good ones.
Right. I think that what I've been using information to do is to help raise awareness of an individual doctor, because everybody, I think, thinks that they're doing a great job, but the metrics of yesterday are different than the metrics of today and will be different from the metrics of tomorrow. In other words, it was all about getting a clinical pregnancy test positive 10 years ago, and we all tried to, I'm 40%, I'm 50%, and now it's a healthy singleton delivery at term. So having a triplet pregnancy is considered a failure by today's model. It was a success a decade ago. So a doctor that is unencumbered by data or wants to rely on the way things are done in the olden days may not be a doctor that an insurer is going to want to use for their patients, because that's going to drive up costs. So even insurance companies like Optum Health and WinFertility and United and Cigna and Aetna, they're developing centers of excellence models.
Yeah, no, it's, well, all my employees would think that every single one of them was doing a great job. It doesn't work that way. So you've got to sort of bin them out to know what someone's good at and where they lie on the curve. How do you incorporate data into the conversations when you're talking to patients? I mean, I'm sure that this for most couples is, either overwhelming or it's, you could be speaking a different language as far as they're concerned.
Right. I think it's so important to ask real questions, assess patients' knowledge base and needs. I mean, somebody who's a 39-year-old that wants to have 3 children, the conversation is not why are you here. The conversation is, what is the ideal family building opportunity look like to you? How many children do you want to have? If you want to have 1 child, well, let's start right now. We can give you clomiphene citrate, which is a fertility pill. We can do inseminations and we can rapidly progress. If you want to have 3 children, then we should probably be thinking longitudinally about when you're 44, it's going to be really tough the next time around. So maybe we should bank some embryos, take fertility medications, retrieve the eggs, fertilize them, test the embryos, freeze the embryos. So when you're 44, you can still have a 39-year-old egg that has already been tested and found to be normal. So thinking about what the journey looks like, what the family building goals looks like. So I think of family planning, not of trying to not get pregnant. I think of family planning as, what does your ideal family look like? So for any couple that comes in, we should have a matrix of data that says, what is the success rate per cycle? What is the cumulative success rate over time? And what is the likelihood of having a healthy baby with each treatment protocol, and find decision support tools, find ways to convey that to a patient in language that they understand, graphically, in writing, visually, with videos. I think that that's part of the obligation of today's physician in every field, but especially in our field of fertility, is we have to really be able to educate our patients. And I also find that this helps patients manage a lot of the anxiety that comes with infertility. So when a couple comes in, there's this tremendous loss of control, which obviously is going to provoke anxiety, especially when the stakes are really high. So we can provide some control by giving information, setting up realistic projections and predictive algorithms so they understand when they are going to be coming in for treatment, what the likelihood of success, and what they do next. And that's all part of, I think, being a good fertility specialist.
So when I think of your field, do apps play a role about how you help manage a patient or the data that you're looking to gather from a patient when they're not present?
Yeah, I think many of our patients now come in with fertility tracking apps, with temperature apps, with there are new tools being developed to use saliva. There's a vaginal thermometer that tracks via Bluetooth to a eye phone or to a watch that ends up tracking moment to moment temperature changes. I mean, there's a lot of tools out there, some of which create anxiety because it just heightened awareness all the time of, you know, the only thing somebody could think about, some of which actually alleviate anxiety, all of which provide big data that will help us ultimately map out the journey and personalize it for each patient.
There's a lot of new analytic tools that have been emerging, you know, hardware, software, et cetera. You know, you work with Eric at Semaphore, and he's, you know, known him for a long time, you know, totally different level of thinking, that guy. But where do you see, you know, things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, you know, all these other methodologies playing a role in the data analytics side of what you're being exposed to?
You're mentioning Eric Schott at Semaphore, who is, I truly believe, one of the great geniuses of our time. And I love getting to work with him because he's brought me a little bit into his world. Like, we've done work assessing the transcriptome of an embryo. In other words, you take an egg, you fertilize it, you create an embryo, and certain genes get turned on or off at certain times, and that's going to predict behavior of an embryo. So we've been learning about RNA sequencing together on embryos, and Eric has got this visualization of these gene networks. In other words, it's not one piece of DNA that gets transcribed into RNA that is going to predict behavior. It is entire networks that work together and predict cellular behavior. So we're really working on a molecular level. And then he creates these networks of information in silico, or basically inside of the computer world. And the goal is that figuring out how to perturb different moments of this network of information can predict behaviors. And the whole point is to take either an embryo and predict its behavior, or use this knowledge on a macro level for a patient or a population of patients and change their trajectory from one that's heading towards sickness, or in our case, infertility, to one that's heading towards health, in our case, fertility. So that's what I've been working with Semaphore and Eric on, is developing molecular tools. And we're going to very quickly get to whole exome sequencing for most patients. So we're going to get deeper knowledge, and then we need the phenotypic information, the history, to go with the genotypic information, what their DNA is. And all of that's going to help us to develop better predictive models and to take better care of patients.
You know, when I think to myself back when I was at Applied Biosystems and we were saying, yeah, we're going to do the first reference genome, to where we are now, it's mind-boggling sometimes when I think about it. I mean, on one hand, it's sort of, we're used to it because we're living it. But on the other hand, you're like, wow, in a pretty short period of time, data has really changed.
It has. And a perfect example of that is the new, you mentioned Eric and Semaphore, this new genetic carrier screening test that we were talking about before. Instead of asking a patient, are you Ashkenazi? Are you Sephardic? Are you Chinese? There will be ancestral inheritance markers baked into the test. So we're going to know somebody's ancestral heritage. And so we're going to know when they have a variant of a gene, whether in that population of people it has been described, whether it causes disease or not. So it's going to provide more meaningful information. And it's called residual risk. If somebody is tests negative for a disease carrying state, whether based on their background, whether it really has been described, and whether that negative is a true negative. So it's using deep information from the exome to have translational tools that will really inform a patient and therefore enable a patient to have a healthy child. And another example is cancer. I mean, we're not going to be calling cancers breast or ovary in the near future. They're all triple negative, triple positive, where the mutation is. So we're going to use deep information about mutations in DNA segments to figure out what the predictive behavior is of the tumor and what the right treatment is for that particular molecular disease, that mutation that is driving disease in that patient.
Part of me, in the back of my mind, I was thinking about, I know that you're utilizing this data in fertility and with children, but some of this data can be extended forward into helping, you know, different adults with different diseases and diagnosing them, so forth. I mean, the data is not solely in the fertility space per se.
Right, and there's overlap to many areas of health, but cancer is that perfect opportunity for fertility specialists to work with oncologists and internists. So a patient that comes in and the grandfather had pancreatic cancer, the grandmother had breast cancer, and the aunt had ovarian cancer. And if you go back generations and generations, and this family has just, there's been tragedies and sick people forever, and we realize that there's a mutation. They have Lynch syndrome, for example, and there's a P53 mutation, and we can do in vitro, take the eggs and sperm, test the embryos. Half of the embryos are going to have the mutation. Find the embryos that don't, put the embryo into that next generation, and that family that has suffered for generations will have health for subsequent generations. It really, on a level that some mathematician and geneticist somewhere figured out these brilliant tools and are putting it into our hands, and then on a human level, we're preventing suffering and promoting health. It really is such a great time to be in this field.
So where do you see reproductive health moving next with the help of all this data?
I think that we're using information to triage patients into pathways. We will be dosing patients appropriately based on maybe this a genetic sequence of their FSH receptor. We're going to develop new markers for embryos to figure out which ones are going to be healthy. We're going to use information to figure out what patients are going to be responsive to different treatment algorithms. And sometimes it's even important to know who is not going to get pregnant. And we also, and maybe have them be okay with adoption or egg donation or sperm donation. And we're going to develop better tools of the uterus. I mean, we think of the uterus as being really receptive to embryos. It's its job. But maybe some people's genes are not turned on and off the right way. There's a different sequence. And just finding a way to optimize a window of implantation so that a healthy embryo is going to implant to become a healthy child. I mean, that's where we're going in this information era, is just collecting more and more data to figure out scenarios that work and don't work, and then to keep vectoring towards achieving goals and vectoring away from achieving failure. And that sounds obvious, I guess, when I say it, but it's really not as easy to do. You need tremendous amounts of information to develop models that could then personalize it and bin a patient into a group that is going to follow the pathway that has been laid out by millions of data points.
The area has changed so much. I'm not sure if medical schools in all these, you know, different areas are keeping up with what someone needs to know. So what would you recommend to people?
I think that medical students should be taking bioethics classes, because we're going to get to this. We're rapidly approaching, or we've even passed, areas of medicine that we haven't been prepared to make decisions on. I would tell them to take genetics classes and math classes, because this big data, you need some computational power to both assemble appropriate models and to interpret them. And then we still need the skills, and hopefully some compassion and thoughtfulness and a background of incorporating huge amounts of information and then translating to an individual will allow us to deliver efficient, cost-effective, precise, compassionate, and successful care. I mean, that's hopefully the way we're going to go.
I like the hopefully. It's so fascinating how much data is changing how we do what we do. I guess one of my final questions is, have you seen this change the business model? And I guess what I mean by that is, I'm always looking at, as an investor in the space, is how is the incorporation of data tweaking the model or blowing up what was and maybe creating something that's new, new opportunities for businesses? I guess, you know, similar to Semaphore or Progyny, but do you see things changing rapidly?
Do I see opportunities for digitizing any medical field? And sure, information will allow us to innovate. and in reproductive medicine, we're such a high-tech field that people are always engineering new widgets and coming up with new. I'm working with a company called Tomorrow, which is a really cool startup that is using robotics and RFID to transform the way we cryopreserve eggs and embryos. So instead of having tanks and tanks all around the country that get filled with liquid nitrogen manually or with an autofill device, there's robotic storage that has a label and an RF with radio frequency ID of each canister around each specimen, so a patient can track where their eggs and embryos are and maybe centrally eventually stored to a biorepository with tens of thousands of other specimens where it's going to be kept safe. And there's a vision of using information, using data, using software, using just like somebody would go on Delta and it's find my luggage. It would be nice to know where your eggs are if you froze your eggs to preserve fertility. And it's just cool innovation that's patient-focused and scaling this opportunity of taking a cell that's less than 100 microns and having a safe journey for it. So I think that there's tremendous opportunity in our field.
I wish you great success with your day job, Semaphore, Progeny, and on all the other projects you're working on.
Well, thank you. It's really been a privilege to be part of your show.
And that's it for this episode. If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.